Welcome to an additional episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament that will not be 40 minutes long. What's going on here? Why is this in your feed? Well, it turns out that there's an entire book of songs, prayers, the Old Testament hymnal, whatever you want to call it, the Book of Psalms. And then there's also a book of sort of wise sayings, you know, a book you know as Proverbs. As Chad and I were discussing what we were going to do with Psalms and Proverbs, we were like, are we just going to hit these eventually and just spend a bunch of time going 40 minutes at a time and ending in the middle of Psalms or doing multiple Psalms an episode or multiple Proverbs an episode? Or how are we going to do this? And we had decided that what we would do is we would begin recording an episode on the Psalms and an episode on the Proverbs after the Psalms. We'll do the Psalms first. And we'll just do that as a companion to what we're already doing. And so what you're going to get, lucky you, is two episodes a week until we work our way through this, which is going to take a while, Chad. And so we're going to be you're going to be getting a little Psalm episode each week alongside your regular 40-minute in the Old Testament. And we won't go 40 minutes. We'll go as long as it takes to go through each one of them. So Psalm 119, you can look forward to that very, very long episode of 40 minutes in the Old Testament. Yeah, so this is the first one of those. This is Psalm 1. And Chad, the Book of Psalms is, in one way, it's my favorite Old Testament book. Even though it's not narrative and that kind of stuff, I'm partial to Genesis. I really love Genesis. It's different than the Psalms. The Psalms is the book that gives you permission to pray in certain ways. Like, if you want to know, like, how to talk to God, that's what the Psalms are. They're talking to God, and it is surprising in that way.
Yeah, because some of the things that we say to God in the Psalms, we probably wouldn't pray if we were just, like, free praying, coming up with stuff on our own. We'll see a lot of examples of that over the course of these 150 prayers. I just probably 2 weeks ago, I was teaching at a local congregation, and I said, by show of hands, whose favorite Old Testament book is Psalms? You know how many hands went up? Zero.
Zero hands.
Which kind of surprised me. I wouldn't say it's my favorite, but I would say it's in my top three.
Yeah, it's weird because it's not, I wouldn't say, if someone asked me straight up what's your favorite Old Testament book, I would say Genesis. That's what I would say.
Yeah.
But there's a reason that if you get a little New Testament, it has Psalms included.
Yeah, absolutely. So, if you said, Chad, all right, you can have one and only one biblical book with you on this deserted island, you know, the whole, which book would you choose? Only one biblical book. I would probably choose the Book of Psalms.
Yeah.
Because you've got history woven into it. You've got all kinds of prayers, everything from what in the world's going on, where are you, to hallelujah. You got everything in there. And so it's in my top three favorites, but it is by far the book I spend more time in than any other biblical book, Old Testament or New Testament. So I try and pray through the Book of Psalms every month, and I've been doing that for a lot of years. So I definitely spend more time in it than I do any other Old Testament book, have more of it memorized than I do any other biblical book, and love it in many ways more than other biblical books. But it's kind of hard to pull me away from Genesis or Exodus because, those are at the very top. So
it is also the most quoted book.
It is. Yeah. If you look at, so for those who have ever studied Greek or maybe have a copy of the Greek New Testament, you look in the very back, the typical edition is called Nestle-Aulin. So you look in the back and it'll have the biblical books in the Old Testament listed out with all the times in the New Testament where there's either a explicit quotation or an echo or allusion to that book. And it's a great resource, especially for people like me who like to notice all these overlaps between Old Testament, New Testament. But of course, there's a ton in Genesis, ton in Exodus, so on and so forth. You get to the Psalms and you find out that the Psalms are quoted more than any other Old Testament book in the New Testament.
Yep.
Yeah. In Psalm 110, verse 1, the Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand until I make your enemies a footstool for your feet. Psalm 110, verse 1 is the most quoted Old Testament text in the New Testament. So, yeah, they are woven into the fabric of the New Testament for sure.
I think it's safe to say, like, in the time of Jesus and the apostles, it's got to be the book that more people have portions memorized than anything else, because it is prayers and songs and this sort of thing. I mean, the same way that you might not be able to quote, you know, six lines from the sermon that your pastor gave on Sunday, but if all of a sudden someone starts playing, you know, Great is Thy Faithfulness, you could probably sing most of it without any help.
Yeah, I would guess that in the first century, because the Psalms were sung in synagogues and in the temple, and no doubt at home, the people had a lot of the Psalms memorized. Especially, you know, I've been in the situation, everybody has, where if you're singing solo, somebody says, hey, Chad, stand up and sing Great is Thy Faithfulness. I might be able to, but if I'm in a group singing it, oh, yeah. No problem, because I'm carried along by everybody else's voices as well. It's kind of like that with the Psalms. If you're in a group and you're singing a psalm, then you just fall into the same rhythm of everybody else. One more thing, and we're gonna accent this over and over and over, and that is that the heart and core of the Psalms is about Christ.
Yep.
So there's different ways that you can approach this with each of the Psalms. But in one way or another, they all relate to him, either as the prayer, the one who's actually praying these words, along with David and along with us, or the one who the prayers are about. So we'll see a lot of examples of that as we go through there. And really no need to say much about Christ in the Psalms as a preface, other than you're going to see, and you're going to hear plenty of that as we go through each of these. Anything else? Dad,
no, man, let's do it. Psalm 1.
Yeah, so I'll just read it. It's only six verses. And this is, I'm reading it from the ESV. Blessed is the man who walks not in the counsel of the wicked, nor stands in the way of sinners, nor sits in the seat of scoffers. But his delight is in the law of the Lord, and on his law he meditates day and night. He is like a tree planted by streams of water that yields its fruit in its season, and its leaf does not wither. In all that he does, he prospers. The wicked are not so, but are like chaff that the wind drives away. Therefore, the wicked will not stand in the judgment, nor sinners in the congregation of the righteous. For the Lord knows the way of the righteous, but the way of the wicked will perish. Pretty brief psalm to start things out with. This really, so I'll say more about this when we next week when we talk about Psalm 2, but just as kind of a prelude to that, I would argue that Psalm 1 and 2 are the double doors that open into the rest of the book of Psalms. And next week I'll accent the overlap of language that we have between these two. So of course, as in a lot of the Psalms, you have a sharp contrast between two groups. You got the righteous, you have the wicked, and they're known by various other names. Sometimes they're referred to as the Hasidim, which is usually translated as saints, or the righteous, or the holy ones, or whoever it might be. You have those, that's one group. And then you have the wicked, or the sinners, or the scoffers, as they're called here. So there's a pretty sharp contrast between these two. Now, we'll see in many Psalms where there's a blending of these two, of course, where that line between good and evil cuts between every human heart. But in this opening psalm, anyway, which is very much in the wisdom genre, you have a stark contrast between these two. Now, notice one more thing that's kind of curious about not only Psalm 1, but other psalms as well. This is not couched in typical prayer language. Because when we pray, we say, oh God, you know, blessed are you, or oh Lord, please give me this, or oh Almighty, I confess my sins to you, whatever it might be. We address God directly. When God is talked about in Psalm 1, he's talked about in the third person. Not so that it's a prayer, I would argue. It's a prayer, but it's not the typical kind of prayer where we explicitly evoke God. Instead, we are speaking to God, but in the third person. And we're talking about who he is and what the blessed man does and the outcome, the different outcomes of the righteous and of the wicked. Now, one thing I want to point out right away is that throughout Christian interpretive history, and I'm fully in line with this, the man in Psalm 1, verse 1, is not understood to be every man, but instead is a reference to the Messiah himself, to Christ.
Yeah, it's a singular word for man, right?
Yeah, it's not. I mean, you do have, even in English, we'll sometimes use man or men in a generic sense, refer to all people, who for us, like in the Creed, who for us men and for our salvation came down from heaven. By that, we don't mean males. We're just using that in a very universal generic sense for humanity. But Hebrew also has the word ish, which is the word here. So Psalm 1 begins in Hebrew, Ashrei Ha'ish. Blessed is the ish, blessed is the man, which refers to a male, to a singular male. And we have this singular man described in detail. He doesn't walk in the counsel of the wicked. He doesn't stand in the way of sinners. He doesn't sit in the seat of scoffers. Well, what does he do? Well, he delights in the Torah of Yahweh. And in that Torah, he meditates day and night. And we have these picturesque descriptions of him where he's like a tree planted, that could also be translated as transplanted by streams of water. He's always yielding his fruit, leaf doesn't wither, and whatever he does, he prospers. In Christian interpretive tradition, this man is understood to be the Messiah, who in Psalm 2 is going to be referred to also as the Son of God and as the Anointed One and as the King. But right away he's introduced here as the one who, in a very regal kind of way, is actually spending his time doing what Deuteronomy 17 says the king should do. Meditating in the Torah day and night. So if you go back to Deuteronomy 17, which is that part about what the Israelite king is not to do and is to do, he's not to amass horses or wives or riches or all these other things. Well, what is he supposed to do? He's to make a copy of the Torah and to meditate in that Torah. That's what the king does. Exactly what this guy's doing.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if you know this about Jesus, but he did not amass wives, riches, or horses. We know this about him for sure. Yeah, he had none of those things. The point here is that it would be inappropriate to translate this word man. So maybe you could, if you're translating something, it's okay for you to translate this word, a word that would say that we might translate for men, and just translate that as people or something like that. So, but you could not rightly translate this. Blessed are people who walk not in the counsel of the wicked. That would not be a valid translation. That this is blessed is a particular person is blessed, and he is a male, and he walks not in the counsel of the wicked, nor stands in the way of sinners, nor sits in the seat of scoffers. You know what's interesting about this too is that you're like, well, I don't know, man. Does this describe Jesus? Because I seem to remember him hanging out with sinners a lot. This is a big accusation against him. Doesn't he do this? I mean, isn't he the friend of sinners? Isn't this what people got all up in arms about? Isn't he associating with the wrong sorts of people? And the answer to that question, of course, is yes, he does. But that's not what it says. It doesn't say that he's not the friend of sinners, or he does not care for sinners. It says that he doesn't stand in the way of sinners. Which is a different thing altogether.
Yeah, when we hear things like counsel, way, seat, these are metaphors that are intended to describe an entire way of believing and doing life, more or less, especially the way. I mean, there's a lot of talk in the Old Testament and New Testament about the way. Of course, that's the first name of Christianity. It was referred to as the way. So it's an all-encompassing term for this is the way you do life. This is what you believe. This is how you act. And so this is saying that doesn't match this blessed man. He's not among the wicked acting like the wicked. He's not among the sinners acting like sinners. He's not among the scoffers acting like scoffers. His delight is not in those things, in other words.
Right. Where is he? That is the contrast there, right? Like, so you have Jesus who eats with tax collectors and prostitutes, but he doesn't collect taxes and hire out prostitutes.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So his he's there, but he's there for a different purpose. He's there because he delights. This is the great thing about this. So the blessed man, the Son of God, his delight is in the Torah of the Lord, and that Torah he meditates day and night. And because of that, not in distinction from it, but because of that, he's a friend of sinners. Because what do you hear over and over in the Torah of the Lord? Well, that God is gracious and compassionate and merciful. And he's always showing this grace and mercy and compassion to who? Well, to sinners. He's actually living among them. He's in the tabernacle right in the middle of the camp. He's forgiving them for all the terrible things that they do over and over and over. And when Jesus meditates up in the Torah of his Father, he is then taking what he learns in the Torah and he is incarnating that in his own life as he becomes a friend of sinners. I mean, you could say Yahweh in the Old Testament is the friend of sinners. And Jesus then continues that in his own life.
Well, he's got to be the friend of sinners or he can't be the friend of anybody.
Yes. Who's he going to be friends with?
This is all there are.
So, reduces your friend pool down quite a bit.
Yeah, and I think it's, you know, people might have noticed that you sort of retranslated this word law. Because this is this verse gets thrown around all the time. And as evidence of what you ought to be doing, which is just sitting there thinking about all the do's and don'ts all the days of your life. Day and night, you're just thinking about what you should and shouldn't do all the time. And that's part of it, but that's not what this is saying. That every day, all day, and at night when you go to bed, just think about the Ten Commandments if you could.
No, you can do that, but you would not be meditating in the Torah of the Lord. At least you would only be meditating a small portion of it. Yeah, the Torah, as we've frequently commented, is the teaching. That's basically what it means. So in the instruction is sometimes the way it's translated. So his delight is in the instruction of the Lord. That is all the things that God has taught us. And we think of Torah specifically in reference to the five books of Moses. This is probably meant in a more, even more general, sweeping sort of way. Anything that God teaches us, whether it's law or whether it's promise, whether it's narrative or whether it's whatever it might be, then he's meditating in this. In other words, we could translate it, his delight is in the word of his Father.
Yeah.
I wanted to do that. Who is he like? Well, then we have two different, very, very different images of what he is like and then what those who are opposed to him are like, the wicked. Well, he's like a tree, not a bush, not a plant, not anything that's kind of passing and shallow rooted. No, he's a tree that's planted by streams of water, and he's yielding his fruit all the time. His leaf doesn't wither. Everything he does, he prospers. So he's got stability. He's got fruitfulness, and this fruitfulness is an ongoing kind of fruitfulness. It never ends. So it's a picture of stability. It's a picture of fidelity. It's a picture of activity and fruitfulness and in all of these blessings because he is meditating day and night in the word of his Father. And then in one line, we have the contrast set up. The wicked, they are not like that. Well, what are they like? They're like chaff the wind drives away. Chaff being a pretty common biblical metaphor for something which is ephemeral, just easily taken away by one little breeze that comes by. So no stability, no fruitfulness, basically just deadness. Yeah. That's all that's that you
the
have
big that's the big thing, right? Chaff is not living.
Yeah. Yeah. Chaff is useless. It's not alive. It's just dead.
It's good for starting fires though.
It's good for starting fires for sure. Therefore, verse 5 says, therefore the wicked will not stand in the judgment. We have the eschaton. We have the last day is already creeping here into this psalm. Therefore, when the judgment comes along, the wicked are not going to stand, nor sinners in the congregation of the righteous. For the Lord knows the way of the righteous, but the way of the wicked will perish, perish like that chaff that the wind drives away.
Yeah, the Lord knows the way of the righteous because he is the only one who's walked it, right? So he's very he knows this road. This is the part of this eschatological thing here, where you know, okay, the wicked aren't going to stand in the judgment, nor sinners in the congregation of the righteous. And again, if you're talking about being righteous, we have to go back to this blessed man. I mean, this really only describes one person. And so you're going to need to be with him.
Yeah. That's the only way that you're going to make this through. In fact, the end of Psalm 2 will make this explicit, where it says, blessed are all who take refuge in him.
That's right.
Yeah, so if you want to be blessed, if you want to be with this blessed man, well, then that's the only way. He's the only one who really knows the way of the righteous, and he's the only one who makes us righteous, declares us righteous by making us one with himself.
That sounds like that sounds like the way is narrow.
It does. It does extremely. In fact, it sounds so narrow, as you've taught me over the years. It's so narrow that there's room for only one person.
That's right.
Yeah, we all get there on the shoulders of the blessed man of Psalm 1, and that's a great way. That's a great way to start out. I mean, it's brief, but in many ways, you've got everything. You find out that the Son of God is going to become a man, an ish, a blessed man, who's going to do what his Father sent him to do. He's going to have stability and fruitfulness. And in the end, because he knows the way of the righteous, then blessed are all going to be who take refuge in him.
That's right. All right. Well, there you go. There's Psalm 1, door number 1 open. Now, next week, we'll open up door number 2 in Psalm 2. Hopefully, this is an enjoyable experience as we go through the Psalms. You get a little additional thing. I don't know if you were looking for more from me and Chad every week, but you got it, whether you we're asking for it or not.
Wanted or not.
That's it. That's how it works. So, all right, Chad. Well, I'll see you next week for Psalm 2.
All right. See you then.
See you.